common rank and file Mexican citizens have an enormous skepticism and suspicion of government because all they've seen is a government that's incapable. My name's Sam Quiñones. I'm a reporter, author. I write now for the Los Angeles Times. Well, the books really have the same theme almost, and that is that people can and have in Mexico escaped that suffocating, paternalistic, central government embrace and gone out and done things on their own. One story was about an entire village where everyone became popsicle maker. And their shops are all across Mexico in the thousands. They're not really a franchise, it's more like a business model or idea that's just been put into practice over and over and over, but all on their own by guys who were just like ranchero types, you know, and poor guys who didn't know that they had any business ability whatsoever until they actually showed themselves that they did. Of course, the second book is Antonio's Gun and Delfino's Dream is all about immigrants. And immigrants, gosh, that's exactly their story. I'm upset with the way things are here. I could wait around for someone else to change it for me, or I could see if things will change. Doesn't look like they will. So what can I do? Well, I can use what I have, which isn't much in this world. It's only kind of gumption, drive, desire to kind of do anything to get ahead and vote with my feet. And of course, millions and millions for 60 years plus now have been doing that. The PRI, the Institutional Revolutionary Party, which ran Mexico for 70 plus years, was really the most successful of the 20th century's many one-party states because it achieved all that control over Mexico without really utilizing secret police to any great extent, no gulags, no tanks in the streets most of the time anyway. It was more of a party that was based on the idea that every person had his price, you know, and in a poor country that wasn't really too high. And so over and over throughout history, you see millions and millions of examples of how the PRI would co-opt movements, people. That's why the UNAM, the university in Mexico City, had for a while 450,000 students, right? 55,000 professors to just keep everyone kind of contained, you know? It was just this big buy-off, essentially. And corruption was the lubricant. It was not some human failing. I write in the first book, it was not a human failing that you see it normally. It was the lubricant. It was essential to the system, and that's how the system worked, and that's part of Mexico's problem today, is that they've still having tremendous difficulty getting over that legacy. There was this rather strange, bizarre, eventually excommunicated Catholic priest who set up his own cult, or a little kind of community in the middle of the Tierra Caliente, which is a particularly violent part of the state of Michoacán, not far from Mexico City. And there, this man kind of ruled over this town. And there were rapes, there was child molestation, there was a lot of bringing people in, selling them property, and then throwing them off the property. All of this was definitely against the law. And they did not allow anyone to walk into the town. I tried this several times. Now, obviously, Mexican Constitution allows for free transit across the country. But this guy's name was Padre Nambor. His place was called New Jerusalem. This little community was able to function outside the law because every election, they voted, everybody in the entire town voted for the PRI. So anybody who was running against the PRI in that little district had automatically to overcome a 1,200 vote margin. It so happened that the very day that I was able to walk into New Jerusalem was their All Saints Day. And everybody in the town has a saint. And it's not just like in normal times where you just have your saint, you kind of think it's a good thing, okay? Everybody dresses up on that day as their saint. And so all around this village were people walking around looking like Moses, like princes out of the Renaissance, people with halos made out of clothes hangers, long flowing dresses. It was as if as if the whole town had walked into an open-air insane asylum. That whole story, I wrote it really based on the idea that this was how the pre co-opted this one little part, but if you multiply that across Mexico, you understand how the pre was able to stay in power for so long. I wrote a story about the town of Southgate, which is southeast of Los Angeles, an area that's now famous or infamous for being the home of Bell, where all the salaries were way out of whack and all that kind of thing. But Southgate was really the first example of just rampant and brazen, outrageous corruption among city local governments. The town of Southgate was run very quickly into bankruptcy by some very unscrupulous people, and write all about it in my story. But the attitude that allowed that to happen was directly out of Mexico, which was politics are something we don't get involved in. We don't know what's in City Hall except for police officers. We don't want to be involved with them. That's not what we're here for. The corrupt politicians in Southgate understood who their voters were, and they began to use a number of the tactics that the pre used, mainly giving away stuff. By the time I came upon it, they had enormous toy giveaway in this huge parking lot, 3,000-4,000 toys, big rides, clowns, tacos, the whole bit. And then at the end, they gave away a house. They gave away a house that the city owned. It was a $500,000 piece of gift to someone. They raffled it off to give to somebody. It was totally a gift of public property, totally illegal, and never happened in the long run. But at the time, it was all about, if we give people stuff, they will vote for us. I went to Mazatlan to do a story really about beauty queens. I just thought it was fascinating. This town was obsessed with beauty queens. There's a beauty queen for almost everything. Restaurants, soccer leagues, firefighters, little leagues, you know, on and on. At part of that, somebody told me that there was a gay beauty contest as well that I should check out. And so I went out there really not intending to spend any more than a day or two there trying to figure it all out. And I ended up spending 8 weeks combined virtually living with this little colony of drag queens as they prepared for what was then the oldest drag queen beauty contest in Mexico. All across Mexico, you would see drag queens. And now, in the United States, you see them like in the urban centers, in the Tenderloin in San Francisco or in Greenwich Village in New York or wherever it is, right? But here in Mexico, you would see them everywhere. They're out in the middle of nowhere, little rural areas. Guys would get on with halter tops and plucked eyebrows. Near my house in Mexico City, every Friday night, there'd be these enormous, gorgeous guys with, 6'3" and Adam's apples. And they'd be out there, hooking on the street corner. So the question was, why is it that a country that's so macho has so many guys dressed up like women, right? What I came to understand was that it's because Mexico is such a macho country that there's so many guys dressed up as women, because you don't dare recognize your own natural homosexuality by sleeping or having sex with a man dressed as a man. Particularly not, especially not, I would say this is where it really is true, in the lower, say, three quarters of the economic scale of Mexico, the poorest two thirds to three quarters of the population. That is just, you want that plausible deniability. Oh, I was drunk. Oh, she looked really like a girl. Oh, I didn't know what I was doing. Through it, I came to understand that these guys were necessary to Mexico. And without them, you kind of feared what might happen, some kind of immense social eruption, explosion, because they didn't have the jotos to kick around anymore. The migration of Mexicans to the United States is clearly the most important migration of any people from one country to another in the last 100 years. Of course, they are a huge part of our working class now. And you see this not just anymore in Kansas, in California or Arizona or Texas, but all across the country. And they at times have saved areas. Parts of Kansas I was in would be dead were it not for their labor. I've often thought that economists ought to use Mexican immigrants as economic barometers. The way they, real estate sales are up, all that kind of stuff. Our Mexican population's up. That ought to be a barometer of economic well-being, because Mexicans do not go where there are no jobs. The reason we have all those jobs. The reason the economics works is because of I think in large part, is because of this real egalitarian sense of that we have, that we put in place and put in enshrined in law and culture and tradition. And that's what I think a lot of times immigrants respond to, especially when they come here. They come here with this idea, I'm going to make some money, send it home, this kind of thing. But what they actually end up doing is seeing how much they can be. Sounds like a army commercial or something like that. Be all you can be. We'll come to the United States and you will show you all you can be. And that's a beautiful story to write. That's so amazing. I see it over and over and over. All these folks come here and have the veil kind of lifted, you know. Mexico loses an enormous amount when that happens, because it's not that these folks always send home money. $26 billion a few years ago. I think it's down to 23 now for this year, something like that, maybe $22 billion. It still doesn't even come close to making up for the loss of dynamic young blood. Mexico has spent centuries building up its central apparatus, its government in the center, its mindset that the central government knows best, etc. And the great tragedy of Mexico today, the great catastrophe of Mexico today, is that it has no local institutions worth the name. You can see it in Ciudad Juarez. Ciudad Juarez is a town that has tons of growth and almost no development, right? There's vast shanty towns. There's no, because the city is drained of all its tax revenue, and it's sent down to Mexico City, and only a little bit comes back, not anything commensurate with the need. Fascinating to see the homicide statistics if you compare Juarez and El Paso or any other Mexican city on the border and its sister city across the border. You know, Juarez has had 3,000 murders, I think, in the last 2.5 years or something like that. Some colossal amount. I've lost count. I try not to count anymore, honestly. El Paso, I think, has had like maybe 60 or 80 or something like that. Why? Because we have developed strong, vibrant, agile, well-funded, really important, local government here. And that keeps a lot of that stuff out, you know, and that's what Mexico needs.